Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are doing something a little bit different, significantly different, actually.
Yeah, this is the new format for us.
It is. Usually, you know, we take a stack of articles, maybe some breaking news or a cultural trend, and we try to synthesize it into a narrative. Mm. But today, well, today we're putting on our reading glasses.
We are. We're initiating what you're calling the study guide edition.
Exactly. The study guide edition.
And I'm actually really looking forward to this.
Yeah.
It's a chance to step away from the, you know, the noise of the news cycle for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And to focus on the fundamental tools of how we actually know things, especially in the social sciences. It's less about what happened and much more about how do we measure what happened.
That's the perfect way to put it. And we're speaking directly to you, the learner, today. So let's just set the scene for who you are right now. You're likely a first-year university student. You've probably just come out of your general statistics courses. You know how to calculate a mean. You know what a bell curve looks like.
Hmm.
You're feeling pretty decent about your math skills.
I'm feeling confident.
You're feeling confident. But now you've enrolled in a course, and it's called something like Analysis of Economics Data, and the vibe has shifted.
It really has. It's a distinct pivot point in an academic career.
Yeah.
You're moving from general statistics, which, let's be honest, can sometimes feel like just abstract math with numbers.
Right.
To econometrics.
Mm.
And that transition can be jarring. It really can. Because suddenly all those numbers are supposed to tell a coherent story about human behavior, about markets, about policy.
And to help you navigate that transition, we are doing a comprehensive, almost line-by-line breakdown of Chapter 1 from the text Analysis of Economics Data by A. Colin Cameron.
We're looking at the November 2022 edition specifically.
That's right. So if you have the book, grab it, put it on your desk. If not, don't worry. We're going to act as your audio companion through the text, and we'll cover every definition and concept you need to survive that first week of class.
And, you know, the mission statement of this text is really worth pausing on for a moment before we just dive into the technicalities.
I agree.
Cameron isn't just trying to teach you how to, you know, click buttons in a software package like Stata or R. The real goal here is to bridge the gap between the raw data and the economic interpretation.
The interpretation, that's the key word.
It is. In a general stats class, if you calculate a number, you're done. You get the check mark. But in econometrics, calculating the number is just the starting line. The real work is asking, what does this number imply about the real world?
It's the so what factor. It's always about the so what. Uh-huh. But before we get into the weeds of the methodology, let's define the term itself. When we say econometrics, what are we actually talking about, at least in the context of this specific chapter?
So in the context of this book, econometrics is the application of specific statistical methods to economic data.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just any method. The star of the show, the absolute engine of this entire field, is regression analysis.
Regression analysis.
Fundamentally,
mm-hmm.
we're looking at situations where an outcome, and we'll always label that outcome, varies based on one or more other variables.
So dollars is the thing we care about.
Yeah.
Dollars is house prices or inflation or weekly earnings.
Precisely. That's our target. And we're trying to see how other variables, which we usually call 6Y, how they influence y'all are.
Okay.
And the text lays out a very clear roadmap for how we're going to get there.
Yeah.
We start with the toolbox, which is the statistical methods themselves.
Okay, it's a toolbox.
Then we look at the raw material, which is the data itself.
Okay.
What does it look like? Then we look at the environment. And this is a big one. Specifically, the problem of causality.
Causality, okay.
And then finally, we get to the engine. Regression.
And we also have to, well, we have to eat our vegetables today, too.
We do.
We're going to spend some significant time on the mathematical notation at the end, because I know that's where a lot of students just, they hit a wall.
It can be intimidating.
It can be. But let's start with that toolbox. Section 1.1 of the text draws a really hard line between two types of analysis.
It does. It's a bifurcation that really defines the whole discipline. On one side, you have descriptive analysis.
Okay.
And on the other, you have statistical inference.
Let's unpack descriptive analysis first, because I feel like this is the safety zone. This is what most people remember from high school math, from their intro stats class.
It is. It's the comfort food of statistics.
Mm-hmm.
Descriptive analysis is exactly what it sounds like. You are describing the data you actually have in front of you.
So no guesswork.
No guesswork. You're summarizing it to make it digestible. Think about it. If you have a spreadsheet with 10,000 rows of census data, you can't just read the rows and understand the trend. It's impossible. It's just a wall of numbers.
Right.
So you do things to summarize it. You calculate the mean, the median or the standard deviation.
And this is where the visuals come into, right? Yeah. The histograms, the bar charts.
Exactly. Those are all tools to visually summarize the specific data set that's sitting on your hard drive. It gives you a snapshot of reality as it was recorded.
And it's factual.
It's factual. If the average of your sample is 50, then the average is 50. There's no debate. It just is. It helps you understand the shape of the data. Is it skewed? Is it flat? Is it clustered around one number?
Okay, so that's what the data says. The text contrasts this with statistical inference. And this this sounds inherently riskier.
It is riskier.
Yeah.
And that's why it's more interesting and more difficult. Statistical inference is the what if and the what else.
Okay.
It's the process of taking that specific sample you have and trying to make a claim about a much broader population that you don't have data for.
Can we ground this in a concrete example just to make it super clear?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So imagine you want to know the average income of the entire United States, the whole country.
Okay. An impossible task.
Right. You can't survey 330 million people. It's too expensive. It takes too long. It's logistically impossible for anyone but the government, and they only do it every 10 years. So what do? You survey, say, 1,000 people.
A small sample.
A small sample. Now, descriptive analysis tells you the average income of those specific 1,000 people you called.
Simple enough. I have a number. Let's say it's $60,000.
Okay, $60,000. But you don't actually care about those 1,000 people. I mean, you do, but that's not your research question.
Right. I care about the country.
You care about the country. Statistical inference is the mathematical framework that allows you to take that sample average, your $60,000, and say, okay, based on this, I am 95% confident that the true average of the entire country falls between, say, $58,000 and $62,000.
So you're building a range of plausibility around your sample number.
A range of plausibility. That's a great way to put it. You are inferring the properties of the whole from the properties of the part.
And this is where all those terrifying terms come from. Confidence intervals, hypothesis tests, standard errors.
It is. That's the machinery of inference. And the source text is very explicit about this. Much of this book and the course you're likely taking entails statistical inference. That's the main event.
I guess the question a student might ask right now is, why? Why make it so complicated? Why the heavy focus on inference? Why can't we just look at the data we have and leave it at that?
That's a fair question.
Yeah.
And the answer is because in economics, we rarely, if ever, have the full picture. We almost never have the entire population.
We're always working with samples.
Always. We don't have data on every single transaction, every single hiring decision, every single firm. We only ever have pieces of the puzzle. So right. If you want to make policy decisions or business decisions, you need to know if the piece you're looking at is telling you the truth about the wider world or if it's just a fluke.
A fluke.
Yeah, maybe you just happened to sample 1,000 unusually rich people by chance. Inference is the tool that measures that uncertainty. It quantifies how likely it is that you're wrong.
So if descriptive analysis is like looking at a high-resolution photograph, statistical inference is like looking at a really pixelated, blurry photo and trying to figure out what's happening just outside the frame.
That is a fantastic analogy. I'm going to steal that one. You're acting as a detective, not just as a reporter.
I like that. A detective.
And to be a good detective, you need to understand your evidence. You need to know what you're working with. And this brings us right to section 1.2 and the classification of data.
The raw material.
The raw material.
So the text outlines three broad types of data.
And this seems like something students might gloss over, you know, yeah, it's numbers. But
yeah,
I get the sense that if you get this wrong, all your math just breaks down later.
It absolutely does. The software, whether it's Stata or Python or R, it will usually try to run the calculation regardless of what you feed it.
It's a machine. It'll do what you tell it. It'll do what you tell it. But the interpretation, the meaning of the result, will be complete garbage if you don't know the nature of the data you're using.
Okay, so let's run through them carefully. The first type is numerical data that is continuous.
This is the big one. This is the main character for this course, especially at the beginning. Continuous means the variable can take on any value within a given range. Think of gross domestic product, GDP, or income, or a person's height.
So it's a smooth scale. There are infinite possibilities between any two points.
Right. You can earn $50,000. You can earn $50,000 and 50 cents. You can earn $50,000 and, you know, 1/10 of a penny if you really wanted to calculate it. There are infinite possibilities.
Okay.
And the text notes that this is the primary focus of Chapter 1 and really the whole first half of the book. Continuous numerical data is the standard starting point for economic analysis. because the math of regression works most intuitively with it.
It's the cleanest case.
It's the cleanest case.
Okay, so that's the main course. What are the other types of data we might run into?
The second type is still numerical data, but it's discrete.
Discrete?
These are still numbers, but they're countable integers. Mm. They can only take on specific values.
Like the number of times you went to the dentist last year?
That's the classic example.
Yeah.
Exactly. You can go 0 times, 1 time, 2 times. You cannot go to the dentist 2.5 times.
Yeah.
It just doesn't exist. It's a distinct stepped value.
There are gaps between the numbers.
There are gaps. The jump from 1 to 2 is a massive leap. There's no middle ground. And I can see how that would confuse a mathematical model that's expecting a smooth, continuous line.
Yeah, if the line it wants to draw goes right through 1.5, the model might be confused because 1.5 doesn't exist in reality.
Precisely. It requires different assumptions about the probability distribution, which is something that comes up in more advanced chapters.
Okay, and then the third type.
The third type is categorical data. And this isn't really a number in the traditional sense at all. It describes a status or a quality or a group.
This would be things like married versus single or employed versus unemployed.
Exactly. Or maybe region, north, south, east, west.
Mm.
In the raw data file, these might be coded as numbers like 0 and 1 or 1, 2, 3, and 4. But they aren't quantities.
You can't do math on them in the same way.
You can't. You can't really average marital status in the same way you average income. If you average married, which we code as 1, and single, coded as 0, and you get 0.5, what does that mean?
It doesn't mean half married.
It doesn't mean half married. It means 50% of your sample is married, which is a useful descriptive fact, but the math has to be handled very differently in a regression model.
So the big takeaway for the learner here is know your variables. Before you run anything, just look at the column in your spreadsheet. Ask yourself, is this a smooth number, a stepped integer, or a category?
That's it. And the expert note in the text really emphasizes that while we focus on continuous data now, the advanced courses will adapt these methods to handle the discrete and the categorical stuff later on. You have to walk before you can run.
Got it. Now, we need to talk about the environment in which this data exists. And this is perhaps the biggest philosophical shift from the hard sciences to economics.
I think so.
The distinction between observational and experimental data.
This is the elephant in the room for all of social science. It truly defines the limits of what we can claim to know.
Let's start with the easy one. In the hard sciences, say chemistry, you have a lab.
Right.
You control the temperature, you control the pressure, you add exactly 5 milliliters of a reactant. You are a god in that tiny universe.
That's experimental data. The data you collect comes from a completely controlled environment that you, the investigator, created. So if your outcome changes, you know it's because you changed your input six times.
Yes, you held everything else constant.
You held everything else constant. There are no other explanations.
But economists don't have labs.
We do not. We can't put the Federal Reserve in a test tube. We can't take the population of France, randomly split it in half,
yeah,
and then raise taxes on one half just to see what happens.
We'd like to, but we can't.
We'd love to, but we can't. We're almost always stuck with observational data.
Data that's based on observed behavior in an uncontrolled, messy, real-world environment.
And the text really emphasizes this point. Economic data is most often observational. And this leads to the single biggest interpretation challenge in the entire field.
Which is?
The difference between association and causation.
The classic. We've all heard the cliche a million times. Correlation does not equal causation. It's practically a meme at this point.
It is.
But the book gives a really specific, powerful example to show why this is so hard to untangle in practice. It looks at the effect of a college degree on earnings.
This is the classic example for a reason. It's so intuitive. Yeah. So let's walk through it very carefully.
Okay.
We observe, using our descriptive analysis tools, that people with college degrees, on average, earn significantly more than people without them.
Right. It's a huge gap. It's verifiable. It's statistically significant.
It's one of the most robust correlations in all of labor economics. So the temptation, the very natural first thought, is to say, the degree caused the higher earnings.
If I just hand a diploma to a random person on the street, their earnings will magically jump up.
Exactly.
Okay.
But that assumes that the degree is the only systematic difference between those two groups of people.
Yeah.
And we know, intuitively, that's not true. This brings up the critical concept of self-selection.
Meaning people aren't randomly assigned to go to college, like in a lab experiment.
No.
They choose to go.
They choose to go. And who chooses to go? Well, it's usually people with higher innate ability or higher motivation, or maybe more supportive family backgrounds and financial resources.
And all of those things, motivation, ability, family wealth, are also things that help you earn more money anyway, completely, regardless of whether you get a degree or not.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So when you see that high salary for the college graduate, how much of it is the actual value added by the diploma, the skills they learned, and how much of it is just the fact that they were a highly motivated, high-ability person to begin with?
And with observational data, those two things are all mixed together. They're confounded.
They are. The variable we have in our data for education is accidentally also picking up the effect of motivation.
Right.
Because we can't see and measure motivation directly.
So without controlling for that self-selection, we cannot claim causality. It's as simple as that. So does the book offer a solution in chapter one? Are we going to solve the causality crisis today?
No, and I actually really appreciate the author's honesty here. Mm-hmm. The text explicitly states that this specific book, especially the early parts, focuses on measuring association.
Just the association.
Just the association. Mm-hmm. We are looking at how variables move together. We are quantifying the relations. We're putting a number on the correlation. But we are being very, very careful not to claim we've proven causality in these early chapters.
That is such a crucial distinction for the students listening. When you write up your results for your first assignment, you have to be so careful with your verbs.
Oh, absolutely. Use words like associated with, is related to, predicts, is linked to, or is correlated with.
And what words should you avoid?
Avoid caused, drove, resulted in, led to, or proves. Don't use those unless you have a very robust, advanced model that, frankly, you haven't learned how to build yet.
And the text mentions that those causal methods, the really advanced tools like instrumental variables or regression discontinuity, are reserved for way later, like chapter 17. So patience is key.
It is. It teaches you intellectual discipline. You have to respect the limitations of your data. If you overstate your case, you lose all your credibility.
Okay, let's move on to how this data is physically organized, the structure. The text lists three main types of data collection structures. And I want to flag this for the listeners. Pay very close attention to the notation here, specifically the subscripts, $1 versus $2,
yeah.
Because this is what you're going to see on the chalkboard or on the slides. And if you mix them up, you are going to be lost.
You will be. The structure of your data dictates the exact math you need to use. The first and the simplest is cross-section data.
What does a cross-section look like in your mind's eye?
It's a spreadsheet. And in that spreadsheet, every single row is a different person or a firm or a country, but all the data in that spreadsheet comes from the same single point in time.
A snapshot.
Snapshot. It's completely frozen in time.
So an example would be a list of the GDP of every country in the world, but only for the year 2022.
That's a perfect cross-section. Or a survey of 500 households that was conducted in May of 2023. The notation here uses the subscript $i.
The letter I.
Right. So if your variable $6 is income, we write it as $6. The dollars just counts the individuals from one all the way up to dollar, or dollar the number of people in your sample.
And the text says this is the primary focus for an intro course.
It is. Cross-section data is the cleanest starting point because you don't have to worry about messy things like time trends or seasonality or inflation. You're comparing apples to apples at the same exact moment.
Okay, that makes sense. Type number two, then, is time series data.
So this just flips the axis. Now, instead of many individuals at one point in time, we're looking at data over time for the same individual or entity.
So instead of every country in the year 2022, we are looking at just the United States, but we're looking at its GDP in 1990, 1991, 1992, and so on, all the way to today.
Exactly. Or the daily stock price of a single company, like Apple. You're tracking the evolution of one variable over a period.
So it's a movie instead of a photo.
That's a great way to put it. A movie versus a photo. And the notation changes here, which is key. We use the subscript for time. So we write $6, where it goes from one to dollar, the total number of time periods.
Okay. Dollar for individual, $2 for time.
Got it.
And then the third type.
The third is the combination of the two, which is often the most powerful. It's called panel data, or sometimes longitudinal data.
And this is the gold standard in a lot of economic research, isn't it?
It often is, because it gives you the most information. This is data on multiple individuals over multiple time periods.
So we have the GDP for the US, the UK, and France. That's the cross-section part. And we have it for every year from 1990 through 2022. That's the time series part.
Precisely. And the notation, naturally, uses both subscripts. $6, This represents the variable $6 for individual dollars at 10 Tuan dollars. This allows us to track how a specific country changes over time and compare it to other countries at the same time.
So why does this distinction matter so much for the student? I mean, can't I just throw it all into the software and hit regress?
You can, but your standard errors, which are the measure of your uncertainty, your precision, will almost certainly be wrong.
How so?
Well, the text highlights that time series data, for example, is often autocorrelated.
Autocorrelated. What does that mean?
It just means that what happens this year is related to what happened last year. They aren't independent events. If GDP was high last year, it's pretty likely to be high this year, too.
Right. It's not like rolling a dice every year. The past influences the present.
Exactly. And the basic math for a cross-section assumes that every data point, every person, is an independent draw from the population. If you apply that faulty assumption to time series data, you're going to get your confidence intervals wrong. You'll be overconfident in your results.
So the structure of the data determines the specific inference tools you need to use to get the uncertainty right.
Exactly. But again, for Chapter 1, we are anchoring ourselves in cross-section data. Keep it simple first. Master the snapshot before you try to direct the movie.
That sounds like good advice. Now let's talk about the engine, the thing that drives this whole course, regression analysis. Section 1.3 makes it crystal clear that this is the tool we use to quantify relationships.
It is the workhorse of econometrics. The text gives a very specific, tangible example to illustrate this. It looks at the relationship between house price, which is our outcome, our X model.
Okay, house price is A.
And house size in square feet, which is our predictor, our $6. This is a classic bivariate example, just two variables. We have data on 29 home sales, and we want to know, how does price change when size changes?
So you run this through the software, and the text notes a specific result from this regression. It says the slope is 74.
This is it. This is the key moment for interpretation. When you run a regression, the computer spits out a bunch of numbers, but the most important one is usually the slope coefficient. In this case, 74. What does 74 actually mean? It doesn't mean the house costs $74.
No, absolutely not. The interpretation is all about change. It's about the marginal concept that is so central to all of economics. A slope of 74 means that within this data set, a one-unit increase in $6 is associated with a 74-unit increase in life.
So one additional square foot of house size
is associated with a $74 increase in price.
Associated with? You caught yourself there.
I did. Very important. It is associated with a $74 increase. It tells us the rate of trade-off. It's a price per unit. So if you were to add 10 square feet to a house, all else equal, you'd expect the price to go up by $740. That feels surprisingly concrete and useful. I think students often get lost in all the Greek letters and the theory, and they forget that at the end of the day, we're often just trying to figure out how much one thing costs in terms of another.
That's the beauty of regression. It compresses a messy cloud of data points on a scatter plot into a single usable number that tells a story.
And the book outlines a clear progression of complexity for how we learn this.
It does. It builds it up logically.
It starts with univariate data.
Right. Chapters 2 through 4 cover univariate data, which is just a single series, $6. This is mostly a review of your introductory statistics course. We're talking means, medians, standard deviations, distributions. You analyze one thing at a time.
Then you move on to bivariate data.
Yes. Chapters 5 through 9, this is where the magic starts. Two series are Uli and our $6. The regression line equation is what you might remember from high school algebra. Ui B1 plus B2 bass.
And that
is our slope. That's the 74 we were just talking about.
And finally, you get to the real world, which is multivariate data.
Chapters 10 through 15. This is where it gets real. Because in the real world, house prices aren't just determined by size, are they?
Of course not. They're determined by location, number of bedrooms, number of bathrooms, age of the roof, the quality of the school district.
Exactly. Dozens of things. Multivariate regression allows us to have many series.
Yeah.
We have our main sixels, which we can call $62, but also 64, all the way up to $6.
And the equation just expands to include them.
It does. It becomes B1 plus B2 by 2 plus B3 by 3 and so on for every variable. It's so powerful because it allows us to control for multiple factors at the same time.
To get closer to that ceteris paribus ideal from Econ 101, all else being equal.
That's the goal. We can now ask, what is the effect of an extra bedroom holding the size of the house and the quality of the school district constant? It lets us isolate effects much more cleanly.
Okay. Before we wrap up the content analysis, we absolutely have to tackle the background section, the math. The text lists specific prerequisites, and I want to walk through them because, as we said, notation is so often the biggest barrier to entry. If you can't read the symbols, you can't understand the concepts.
Absolutely. It is like trying to read music. If you don't know what the notes on the staff mean, you can't play the song. It doesn't matter how good the piano is.
First up, the big one. Summation notation. That big, scary Greek letter, sigma.
It looks scary, but it's used on almost every single page of the text. You are going to see semi-1 constantly.
But it's really just an instruction, right? It's not a concept, it's a command.
It's a loop command. For those of you who have done any coding, it simply means add up all the six rawas. That's all it's saying.
Let's break it down. The text below the sigma, the high I dollars.
That tells you where to start counting. Start with the first person in your list, the text above the sigma, the 9.
That tells you where to stop.
Right. Stop at the last person dollar. So sum up $6 for everyone from person 1 to person dollar.
The text gives a specific example to work through. Semi 1, 3, 2 plus 3i. Let's just calculate that out loud to show how.
Okay, let's do it. So the sigma command tells us to run the formula inside the parentheses, $2 plus 3s, yeah. 3 times for y on I 2 and I 3 dollars.
Okay, first pass. Set y dollars.
The term is $2 plus $31, which is $2 plus 3, so that's 5.
Got it. Next, set I $2.
The term is $2 plus 32, which is $2 plus $1 plus 5, so that's 3.5.
And finally, set I 3.3.
The term is 2 plus 33, which is $2 plus $3, so that's 3.
And the sigma means sum, so we just add up those three results, $5 plus 3.5 plus 3.3.
Which gives us 11.5, mm-hmm. And that's all it is. It's just a compact, neat way of writing a very long addition problem. If you can do simple arithmetic, you can handle summation notation. Don't let the Greek symbol intimidate you.
Okay. Next up, the text mentions calculus, and it says, quote, it is used occasionally, but is not essential. Is that true? Or is the author just being generous to nervous students?
He's being accurate for this level of text. You don't need to be able to solve complex integrals or anything like that. But you do need to understand the concept of a derivative conceptually.
Conceptually.
The text uses delta notation, which is a good bridge. The triangle symbol, delta. So delta gay just means the change in yaw, and delta gay means the change in seven.
So Delta just is a rate of change, rise over run.
It is the slope. It represents the change in yaw that happens when $6 changes by 1 unit. The connection to calculus is that the derivative, which is written as debit dollar xx, is simply that same rate of change, that same slope, as the change in $6 becomes infinitesimally small, as delta approaches zero.
So for the purposes of this course, when a student sees a derivative symbol like d delta dx, what should they think in their head? What's the translation?
Think slope. Think marginal effect. If you see DLDS, just translate it in your head to the question, how much does that move if I nudge $6 just a tiny little bit?
That makes it much less abstract and much more useful. The text also mentions natural logarithms and exponentials, which it says will come up in Chapter 9, and then expected values.
Expected value is a big one. You'll see it denoted as ECX dollars.
Is that just a fancy way of saying average?
It is, but with a very specific nuance. It's a fancy way of saying the theoretical average. The long-run average, the mean of the entire population, which we usually call by the Greek letter mu mu.
And then there's the population variance, which is built on that.
Right. And the formula looks really dense. It's sigma EX mu.
That looks like a mess.
It does. But just read it like a sentence from left to right. It's the expected value of the square distance of a random data point from the mean.
So it's the expected squared error.
That's all it is. It's just a way of measuring how spread out the data is. If the variance sigma to nulls is a big number, the data is all over the place. If it's a small number, all the data is clustered tightly around the average.
Okay, that makes sense. We have the toolbox, the data types, the collection methods, the engine, and the math. We've pretty thoroughly unpacked Chapter 1, but just listening to us talk about it isn't going to get anyone an A in the course.
Not at all. And the text is very explicit about this. It points to one key learning tool, and that tool is a philosophy, learning by doing.
You cannot learn econometrics by reading about it in an armchair. You can't learn to swim by reading a book about swimming.
You have to get in the pool. You have to get your hands dirty. The prescribed method for success in the book is twofold. First, you have to perform the data examples using an econometrics or statistical package.
Stata, R, EVUs, Python, whatever your course uses, you have to actually run the code.
You have to run the code. And second, you have to complete the chapter exercises. Do the problem sets.
It's like learning a language. You can read the grammar book all day long, but until you actually try to speak it and probably make a few mistakes, you don't really know it.
That's a perfect analogy. The implementation of these statistical methods is absolutely required to truly understand the interpretation. It's when you see that error message pop up on your screen, or you get a result that makes no sense, like a house price that's negative, that's when the real learning happens.
Because you have to troubleshoot. You have to figure out where the reality and the math went in different directions.
Exactly.
So here's our strategy for you, the learner. Don't just read chapter one. Open your software. Find a data set, any data set your professor provides. Run a mean. Run a histogram. Try to replicate that slope of 74 logic with your own data. Find two variables and see what the slope is.
Connect the abstract definitions we discussed today to the concrete numbers that appear on your screen. That is the only way you build real intuition.
Before we sign off, I just want to leave the listener with one final thought to chew on. We talked a lot about the limitations of observational data. We said that economics is mostly observational and that observational data struggles with causality.
Right. It raises a really profound question about the field itself.
If we can so rarely prove causality in a truly scientific experimental sense, and we are mostly just measuring association, how much of what we consider established economic truth is actually just really, really strong correlation that we as a field have collectively agreed to assume is causal?
That is the danger zone. And it's a healthy skeptical question to keep in the back of your mind. It sets the stage for why critical thinking is so important in the future chapters. As you move forward, you'll learn techniques to get closer to causality to rule out alternative explanations, but you should always maintain that healthy skepticism.
Am I seeing a cause, or am I just seeing a very compelling pattern?
A pattern is not a proof. That should be written above the door of every economist's office.
A pattern is not a proof. I like that. Keep that in mind.
Indeed.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive study guide. Good luck with the semester. Good luck with chapter one. Now go open that software and run your first regression.
Happy analyzing.